We do not have a quorum, but it's time to get started. And Representative Benson has House File 382, and we'll start the testimony, and we'll have to move it later when we get a quorum. So, Representative Benson, House File 382.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. We'll discuss it here for a little while. Just a few moment comments for me, and then I'll turn it over to our testifier. Minnesota saw over 3 million visits to food shelves in 2012. Children represent 40% of the visits. And food shelves throughout Minnesota have seen an increase of 164% visits in the last decade. And with the exception of 2009-2010, when one-time funding increases were secured, state food shelf funding has remained flat since funding began in 1992. State food shelf funding goes to food shelves covering the entire state of Minnesota. So we'll begin with our first testifier.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Benson. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We represent more than 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota, along with working in partnership with the food banks and with a variety of feeding programs. We're here today to really talk about the food shelf funding. We're lucky in the state of Minnesota in that there's been state resources that have been dedicated to this. But as Representative Benson mentioned, there really hasn't been any kind of increase to this fund since its inception, with the exception of those 2 years when we were in the depths of the recession. The important thing I think to remember about food shelf funding is that this goes directly to the food shelves for them to use to keep the lights on and to keep the organization running. The pace that the food shelves have experienced in the last decade has been extraordinary. 164% increase in the numbers of visits to food shelves in the state of Minnesota. That's about 3 million visits last year. Food shelves come in all shapes and sizes throughout the state of Minnesota. We work with them on compliance issues. We work with them on education and training. We work with them on efficiency issues. And most particularly, we work with them on nutrition issues to make sure that the amount of food that's given to people is in sync with their families. This emergency response, which really started in the 80s, has been the backbone of the community response to hunger. Families have experienced extraordinary increases, not to mention job loss, not to mention getting back on their feet. People have really come to depend on the food shelf as a community resource. So I have several members of our food shelf community here today to testify about what it's like to be on the front line. The first representative who will be testifying is Kathy Mays. She's the executive director of ICA Food Shelf in Minnetonka. Kathy?
Thank you, Colleen. Good morning. As Colleen said, I represent a food shelf in the western suburbs where there is no hunger. Actually, there's a lot of hunger, and I'm here to tell you about it. And there is a fallacy that the suburbs are immune to what Colleen has talked about. I was with a board member the other day, and he mentioned we're going through much like the Depression. The only thing that's different is that there are people standing in lines waiting for soup. They have innocuous, anonymous EBT cards, and they get to come to a friendly food shelf like ours. So we do our work and measure our work in a few different ways, and so I thought I'd share that with you so you better understand our needs and the fervency of our work. We measure our work by the amount of people that we see on a given month or a given year. We measure pounds in and pounds out. We're audited very closely. And then we measure a third method, and that's called food services. And so I look at that as how many times our door revolves for people needing food, whether it's a small amount, whether it's a delivery, the first time, the second time they come. It's sort of like drinking water out of a fire hose. It's how many times our door revolves. Since 2008, our numbers in the western suburbs are up 130%. In the business world, being up 130% would be great. In our world, we clench our teeth and hope that we have funding for the next year to keep up with that demand. I had my bookkeeper look to see how much money we spent in 2008 simply on food. It was $64,157. As of yesterday, just 4 months into our fiscal year, we have already spent $71,000. So we're on track to spend over $200,000 plus in food for this year. Simply put, we have become a supermarket for many, many, many of our families. We are not emergency. We're not one time. People come to us versus going to a grocery store. So thank you for your consideration of this, and thank you, Representative Benson.
Our next testifier is Byron Lair. Byron is the president of the Community Emergency Assistance Program in Anoka and Brooklyn Center. Byron.
Before we get to him, we now have a quorum. I will call the meeting to order. And we have four sets of minutes that all involved with Representative Atkins' House File 5. And I do know that Representative Grunhagen was at all. No, you missed the one.
Did I?
The Friday one. But
no, I was there on Friday.
Oh, you were? Okay, okay.
Don't you remember I gave that speech at Little Conference?
Yep. So if you would move the minutes.
I don't want anything to do with House File 5, to tell you the truth.
Okay. Representative Lossberger.
Mr. Chair, I would be delighted to move the minutes of, I'm just trying to catch all the dates, February 14th, February 15th, February 18th, and February 19th, 2013.
Any discussion? Other than Representative Grunhagen did not like the bill. Okay, no discussion? What? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Minutes are approved, and I will now move that House File 382 be recommended to pass and... and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Continue.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm Executive Director of Community Emergency Assistance Programs, better known as CEAP. We operate a food shelf in Hennepin County in Brooklyn Center and also one in the Human Services Center in Blaine in Anoka County. One of our family service workers will be testifying immediately after me and giving you a little bit more personal story about the people who come to the food shelf, but I wanted to give you an overview. We've passed out a chart that shows the the number of families that we have seen over the last six Januaries. It's five calendar years. If you look at that first number, we saw 723 families in January of 2007, increasing to 895, to 1,051, to 1,058, to 1,216. Last year it was 1,422, and last month it was 1,599. The people who come to us work marginal jobs, they don't have benefits, they're the ones that are the least likely to get hired very quickly when an economy turns around. They come to us when they really need it. Our typical family comes in between three and four times a year. We know that they could well benefit from coming in more frequently. They tell us that they don't want to take food away from somebody else that they think who needs it more. And we try and convince them that the community has been generous, this legislature has been generous. We don't want parents to be skipping meals so that their kids can eat. But again, they come in when they really, really need it. I'll give you just a couple of examples of the kinds of people who come to us for food. You may not realize this, but I go to Fantastic Sam's. And the stylists that work on my hair, there are two of them that I regularly see there. They're our food shelf clients. And they tell us that people are skipping haircuts or they're stretching them out in this economy.
And if the customers aren't coming in, they don't get the work and they don't get the tips. The folks that I go to actually had a good Christmas. December was a good month. And when I went in just before Christmas to get my haircut, there was a box of food with 65 pounds in it that the same people who were using our food shelf the 2 months before decided to donate to the food shelf because they wanted to give back. The other person that I am constantly seeing in my mind, a couple of months ago, my church held a blood drive. And the young lady that was drawing my blood when she found out I worked at a food shelf asked me where she could go either in the evening or on Saturday because she worked the blood mobile. And she was never in a position to get to a food shelf near her house when it was open. And because she's on the blood mobile, her car was parked someplace else when the day was done. Fortunately, our food shelf is open 2 evenings per week, and I was able to tell her about another food shelf that was open on Saturdays. In fact, today, this Wednesday, between 3 and 6 p.m., there will be between 80 and 100 homeless students coming to our food shelf. We have a partnership with a local church, the Y, and one other organization. We've been able to get laptops, flash drives, and they can come and get some work done. The church has a nurse that comes over periodically. And our food shelf regularly will be open to 8 tonight. And between 5 and 9, Accountability Minnesota will be using our offices to provide free tax service to low-income families. We try and make this a one-stop shopping center. Some of you may be aware that we recently completed work on a brand new addition to a school building in Brooklyn Center. It is the first regional hub for Hennepin County's Health and Human Services employees. They have 250 folks in the building. The three organizations have formed a condo to run this building, and we've each pledged to work with one another. We share similar clients. We intend to interrupt the cycle of kids dropping out of high school and work closely to close the achievement gap that we see among our students. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Monica Johnson from our Anoka office. Thank you.
Thank you, Byron.
Welcome to the committee. And when you start, if you state your name for the tape.
My name is Monica Johnson, and thank you for having me, Chairman Huntley and committee members. As I just said, I'm Monica Johnson. I live and work in Blaine, Minnesota. I'm employed by SEEP Community Emergency Assistance Program. I've worked at both facilities in the Brooklyn Park office before they moved to Brooklyn Center, and then also in the Blaine office for the last couple years. The families that I help come and see us at the Community Human Services Center for Anoka. We provide food that's 3 to 5 days worth of food for them and connect families to other resources. I spend a lot of time in my office talking to families that don't know about other resources that are out there, so I think that that is a good benefit to what we do. And I have an example of a person that I've worked with. Well, she's no longer in our area, but her name is Tammy, and we saw her regularly, usually once a month, because people can use our food shelf once every 30 days. And her husband had 5 children and lived in Anoka. He was a union woodworker. She would work full-time, but she couldn't because of the cost of daycare, so she only worked part-time when her kids were in school. Despite his full-time and her part-time job, they couldn't keep up with the mortgage payments, living expenses, and make ends meet at the end of every month. Then he was injured and he lost his job. SEEP's food shelf helped stabilize the family until they could sell their home that they could no longer afford. They did finally end up moving to a smaller home north of the metro area, and while things are still tight financially for them, they are making it. Food shelves like SEEP offer families more than just food. We provide dignity in how we work with families, and we know other resources that can be tremendous assistance in times of financial distress or crisis. And one of the things I can tell you from personal experience is I am a single mom that has raised 2 girls, And when I, 20 years ago, I remember going to a food shelf in Northeast Minneapolis. And when I went there, they handed me a box of rice, a thing of cheese, and a box of powdered milk. And I didn't feel too great about walking in there. I never walked into a food shelf again until I started working at SEEK. And the dignity and the way that people are treated there, it's just, it's tremendous. And what we do for the community, I get thanks and tears at least 4 or 5 times a week. And a lot of people come back and they want to volunteer. They say to me all the time, I'll be back as soon as I can get a job. They're excited about talking to me about job opportunities. A lot of times, sadly, they come back the next month and it didn't come through. But I believe that food shelves help a lot of the community that fall through the cracks. The people that they're looking at their gross income, and we all know that gross income is not what your net is when you come home, or when it comes home. So, you know, a lot of the people that we help fall through the cracks. They can't get help through other services because they say that they're overqualified, and that is a major part of our people that come to see us. So, thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend the work that you folks are doing. It's a really good work, but I'm going to write down the date of your testimony, because I think that the testimony that you gave was very good just in terms of testifying. Mm-hmm. Just I think the personal stories are very, very important for the committee, and new information about the people that you serve is very important. So the next time I have a couple of folks that I want to come in and testify, I'm going to have them watch your testimony if we're on, because you really did a very good job, both of you, I think, of giving the committee really good, detailed information, facts and figures. So I just want to commend you on both the work you're doing as well as on a really well-organized testimony for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to recognize, of course, that one of the testifiers was my constituent, Byron, and I'm glad to see him here in committee. And I have a question for the work that you do. Are you coordinating at all with the high schools? I know a lot of the high schools in Anoka-Hennepin have recently started up food shelves in the nurse's office because they determined some of the kids' behavior that went downhill a little before breaks was due to some apprehension of not having the opportunity to eat as regularly. And so I know they've set up a program where, you know, kids can kind of confidentially get some food to bring home over the breaks. And I wondered if you've had the opportunity to network with the high schools at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the short answer to your question is yes. The homeless students that I was describing earlier are generally referred by the schools and are primarily high school students. The one advantage that our food shelf has over the typical food pantry in a school is that we have refrigeration equipment, and we can provide more nutritious meals than they can, which is why we try and partner that way. And the same goes true with our technical colleges and the community college in the Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center area. They're struggling students too, and we work with them.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your presentation. Thanks for your work. We have food shelves out in my district too, obviously, and I try to contribute to them or donate to them regularly to help them out. And I know a lot of local businesses and individuals do the same. I was under the impression, though, I mean, you talk about 300 food shelves, and is that all the food shelves in the state of Minnesota? Because I was under the impression in my district that they just rely on local donations, or is that?
Of the 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota, those are the ones that that are nonprofit agencies or that are arms of nonprofit agencies like churches. There may be some small food shelf that's not counted in that number that only serves maybe the constituency of the church, but these are the 300 public institutions that are open to the public.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question, you know, of that $500,000, how much, you talked about $200,000 being used to purchase food. Is that, the rest goes for overhead expenses, or?
No, we don't have an exact on that. What we do know is that of the $1.2 million in state funding, that leverages $11 million in food and other resources that is used by the food shelf to contribute to the people who are in need. And the way that leverage really takes place is they use that money that is available to them, and it's decided on an equity basis by the numbers of people that they serve. So we monitor that very closely. They report statistics on a monthly basis, and we do the allocation that way. And then they use it at places like food banks and others where they can get a lot more for their dollar. The actual charitable response to hunger in the state of Minnesota is only about 5%. The majority of the way that food shelves serve people is through government programs like the TFAP program, which is the commodities program, and others. And that, of course, with facing the sequester, the SNAP program itself, which is food stamps, will not be harmed right away. But all the programs that are ancillary to those hunger programs will experience a cut if sequester takes place.
Okay.
And next we have Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask, when you have your 3 million visitors,
yes,
does that include the schools? And because I'm also from Anoka County, you know, we've got not only the five high schools, but several of our middle schools have food shelves, and they're heavily used. And I know my church also. Do they give out food, but they give out vouchers so people can go to come and places like right. that to pick up food.
Ms. Maillard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that if they're working with the food bank to get the food in the schools to distribute, then those numbers are counted. Mm-hmm. The church, I'd have to know which location it is, but most of the churches that have food shelves or work, many churches work together collaboratively with a local food shelf. For instance, Prism in Golden Valley is one that works like that. Those numbers would be reported in that way. It's reported to the food bank and then to us. Kathy Mays from ICA may have some additional information.
Mays.
Mr. Chairman, Kathy Mays, thank you. For high schoolers, in our area, we serve Minnetonka High School and Hopkins High School. And we have started a program at Minnetonka High School because they don't hit the numbers for free and reduced breakfasts. So we're actually serving 100 breakfasts every morning at Minnetonka High School. The way that we count that is by pounds. So we know how many pounds go out the door to serve those breakfasts. As far as Hopkins High School and Minnetonka High School, we offer black backpacks filled with food to take home on a Friday, take home before a break, to take home whenever they need it. So those are counted as pounds, and we know how many backpacks go out, and so that we would know how many children are being served, if that helps quantify and qualify.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up. I would venture to say that the 3 million number is probably
low.
Way less than the actual number of people that are getting assistance in some way.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next is Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was very glad when Representative Benson introduced this bill, but I asked him a question about adding an amendment. Well, now it's too late to add an amendment now, but I would like to bring it up so that if this makes it through to an omnibus bill, and I hope it does, that I would be adding it then. And the idea is that this is on top of all the funding that goes out now through OEO and Hunger Solutions. The Office of Economic Opportunity is the part of DHS, which handles the funding, and then it's given to Hunger Solutions, which is a nonprofit, then distributes it to, I believe, 8 food banks, which then it goes out to the food shelves. And OEO takes 1.8% for administrative overhead, and Hunger Solutions can keep up to 4% for administrative overhead. And I just thought, they're already covered. They already have their administrative overhead. Everything's going along, assuming we don't have sequester. But at the same time, by the time this bill gets to an omnibus bill, hopefully that sequester business will be done. So I'm assuming that to be able to distribute a little bit more funding to these places doesn't require any more administrative overhead. You just, you know, simplistically change the number on a page, but on a check. But So I would be bringing an amendment that says for this particular addition, 500,000 or whatever it is per year, that there wouldn't be the 1.8 and the 4% taken out because the administrative overhead is already covered, and this is just an additional thing that we want to get out to the people. We really want it to land in the hands of the people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, I believe that the Department of Human Services and OEO does not take their fee from the money, from the food shelf money. And Hunger Solutions does have an administrative fee, and the reason that we have an administrative fee, although I absolutely understand your concern about getting the money out to the people who need it in as efficient and whole manner as possible, the reason that we have that is that the money comes from OEO to Hunger Solutions. We distribute it directly to the food shelves. It doesn't go back to the food shelves. We to the banks. We distribute directly. And to do that, we have to engage in this process that I described, which is gathering all the statistics about all the use, taking the money, and making sure that it's distributed in an equitable manner based on the numbers of people using the food shelves. And so it really is that administrative fee is used to cover that purpose. Now, as I said, I do understand your concern, absolutely, and I share your concern about getting as much funding out to the food shelves as possible. But we also have a responsibility to be the most effective stewards as we can of the funds. And to do that, we have to be able to rely on the statistics and the way that we do it to make sure that it's distributed equitably.
Representative Lane.
Perfectly understandable, but this is additional on top of you're already doing that. You're already having the numbers from the food shelves. You're already distributing the money. This is an additional piece of dollars on top of that. Like I say, change the number on the check. And so I will be bringing forth that amendment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Moriarty or any of the other testifiers. One of the things that you're addressing an important problem, and but we do have other tools as well. And at least I know I had heard a few years ago about how much we were underutilizing the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or food support. And I am concerned that we still have a lot of people who are dependent on food shelves who would be eligible for SNAP, which is 100% federal paid, allows them the dignity of going into their local grocery store and supporting those local jobs and selecting things that their family prefers as opposed to just what happens to be on the shelves that day at the food shelf. And I'm wondering to what degree you would react to a requirement that our food shelves actively promote enrollment in SNAP. I know some do, some choose not to, but they have the screening tool that's an online tool is so easy mm-hmm. to get a preliminary assessment. And I think you could really do a lot, too, in helping our poor people or people who are living on the edge understand it's not food stamps like it was 50 years ago. It drives me nuts that the press continues to use that term. Instead, you get an electronic card that you swipe just like your debit card or a Visa card, and it's a much more dignified process. And I think we could stretch your efforts dramatically if we could get more and more people comfortable with understanding the program and enrolled in it. It may not always work for everyone, but I do think it's a program we're underutilizing, and I would like your reaction.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, you are absolutely right on target. We have been working with a large collaborative, including General Mills, who gave us a Good Works grant to look at marketing the SNAP program to two particular market groups. One was the recently unemployed, and the other one was seniors, who are historically very under-enrolled in the SNAP program. We've engaged in this marketing program. Our numbers have gone up. We have a state outreach program run by the Department of Human Services and the Office of Economic Opportunity. And in addition to that, we run, in the last 3 years, we have instituted the Minnesota Food Helpline out of our office at Hunger Solutions, which is a 800 number which receives calls from all over the state, every county in the state, of people looking for assistance where we use that very screening tool. So I absolutely agree with you that we are on pace to to increase the numbers of people using SNAP. That is the way to decrease, as you said, some of the pressure on the food shelves. And we make all of these tools available at no cost to every food shelf in the state of Minnesota. We give them posters. We give them, you know, we give them a whole media package of tools to use on this. And so I think that requiring the food shelves to talk about food stamps is not something, I believe, first of all, that most of them do that, but some of the very smaller ones may not. But that we would agree that that is appropriate thing for food shelves to talk about, is that people who are eligible for the SNAP program should be enrolled in it. The hesitancy to be enrolled in the SNAP program, though, has been the public image that the program has had in the past, and part of it has been that people just find the enrollment in the program to be cumbersome. This month, I believe, the Department of Human Services is premiering a one-page senior application, which I think will go a long way towards helping people become enrolled in the program who are seniors who are not necessarily interested in being enrolled in a lot of the other programs. And as we move through health care reform, when we institute a lot of the online application tools for the exchange and for other programs, there will be an opportunity to bring other programs into that, like SNAP, where people can actually become enrolled in the program online. So we work very closely in partnership with the Department of Human Services and with our food shelves, and we agree that we need to do everything we can to make sure that this works well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really would like to pursue that, because I think as while it is cumbersome to explain public programs, and I will welcome anyone's idea on further streamlining the application. I know I've worked with you in the past to make some of those strides forward. I do think it's also very cumbersome and difficult for us to raise the resources that are needed to do these kinds of expansions, and you know, to have a federal program underutilized that in many ways has you know, an ability to expand and enhance things, I think is really important. And yeah, so I'd be glad to work with you and others on how to streamline the application process, how to, but I think every food shelf that receives these funds should have posters or, you know, do some kind of outreach in order to make sure that people are aware of the program. And I did catch you twice referring to it as food stamps in your testimony, and I think all of us have to work on that, because, you know, it reinforces a stereotype that has not been true for a long period of time, and it really is a barrier to people stepping up to what is a food support program offered without having to hand out uniquely looking coupons in front of your peers. And I think that is a barrier to people's willingness to even explore it.
Absolutely, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Next we have Representative Grunhagen.
No, I think
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question following up on what Representative Lane was talking about, and I agree with a lot of what she was saying in terms of changing the number on the check. Versus, and I guess I agree with what you're saying, but I'm trying to compare it to what the bill currently does and how this money would flow. So I don't know if for the author or you, Mr. Chair, who would best answer that question, or someone from the department. But how would this currently flow? I see it would go to the Commissioner of Human Services, but how would it flow compared to what Representative Lane is suggesting?
Mr. Chair, members of the
Ms.
committee,
Moriarty.
I believe that the amendment that Representative Lane is proposing does not affect how the money would flow. The money flows to the Department of Human Services, to the Office of Economic Opportunity, and then to Hunger Solutions, where we have the ability to know who's eligible for what funds, and then directly out, so to the food shelves. So I think currently the Office of Economic Opportunity, and we have two people from the department here, does not charge a fee, so they wouldn't affect them at all. It would be Hunger Solutions that wouldn't be eligible for the administrative cost.
Representative Mack.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, maybe if Representative Lane could then also respond, but I think we all share the interest that not more money goes to administration, but we get as much into the hands of the people that need it. And so I'm not sure I hear much of a difference between what Ms. Moriarty said, if it's going to flow to the department, to the OEO and then to Hunger Solutions. Isn't that the same thing you were just suggesting, or where's the differential, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
Representative Lane.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's how the the accountability flows through DHS to OEO and then to Hunger Solutions as the nonprofit that distributes it. So Hunger Solutions then takes 4% off it for overhead, but I'm suggesting that this extra piece doesn't need extra overhead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And,
that helps.
We need to get on to Ms. Martinez.
She's not
here. Okay,
yes,
so
I think we're finished with testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me?
I think we're finished with our testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. any further discussion? If not, then this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Benson, but don't leave your seat.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and so I would move this one. Yeah, okay. I would move House File 396, and it would be referred to the bonding.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were being very generous with me and all my bills this morning, so I really appreciate that, and I'll try to expedite the process here. I will make a brief introduction and introduce Judy Shortall and James Moore. Judy Shortall is the Executive Director of the St. David's Center for Child and Family Development, and Dr. Moore is the Medical Director. But St. David's Center for Child and Family Development is seeking a $3.75 million state bond funds to leverage $8.5 million in private funds to renovate and expand the center so it can help more children with mental health, autism, and other developmental problems. And by the way, Mr. Chairman, I'm beginning my seventh year here in the legislature. This is the first time I've ever introduced a bonding bill.
No.
Those of us in the west suburbs don't do that very often. So I'm very excited that I have this opportunity this morning. St. David's provides a variety of services for 2,200 children plus their families each year, so the children can succeed in school and grow up to lead full lives and contribute to their communities. It has a success rate of over 90%. The need for St. David's services is great and growing. For example, only 20% of children who need mental health services are receiving them now. Its renovation expansion project will enable St. David's to help meet that need by doubling the number of children and families it serves. And I just have a little quote from the Mental Health Legislative Network, 2013 Legislative Issues, and I think it's relevant to why we're proposing this bonding. And I quote, lack of access to treatment and supports compounded by community attitudes have resulted in poor outcomes for children and adults with mental illnesses. 70% of youth in the juvenile justice system have one or more mental health diagnoses. An estimated 56% of people in prisons and 64% of people in jails live with a mental illness. More than half of those who are homeless have mental illness or chemical dependency, and over 500 people in Minnesota die every year from suicide. And, you know, I was a teacher for a lot of years, and we would discuss the reform movements of the 1820s, and all of you have heard of Dorothea Dix, I'm sure. And Dorothea Dix was talking in 1820s and 1830s about how mental illness is a treatable disease, not something that has been imposed by a wrathful God or a devil or just plain being ornery. So St. David's, I know very well. My two children attended preschool there many, many years ago. And so it's a great honor for me to be able to introduce this bill and introduce Ms. Shortall, who will make some comments in a few.
Thank you.
Introduce your name to the chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Benson, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Julie Shortall, and I am St. David Center's Executive Director. Have been with St. David Center almost 25 years, and am delighted to be here today to share with you about our organization, the reach of the organization, the mission, the strategies to reach more children in the community, and to give you more information about the bonding bill that Representative Benson has authored. I'm here today on behalf of, as well on behalf of my board, who is fully supportive of this bonding request and all that it means for the organization. And Hennepin County Board is also very supportive of our request. And I'm here with my colleagues. Dr. James Moore is the medical director at St. David Center and also a developmental pediatrician from Children's Hospital who has years and years of experience in this field and can help speak to the reach of St. David Center services. And I'm here as well with my colleagues, Erica Tennyson, who's our managing director of programs, and Beth Fagan, who's senior director of our pediatric therapies and autism programs, so that they can answer questions if you have them. So I would like to start by giving you an overview, a brief overview of St. David Center, of the need in the community and our strategies to meet those needs, the project for which we are requesting bond funding, project renovation and expansion, and how that will help us meet growing needs in the community, and then our bond funding request itself. And finally, any financial benefits that there might be to the community as a result of this investment. So I'll start with a brief overview of St. David Center. St. David Center is a 50-year-old organization which started in the basement of St. David's Episcopal Church as an outreach to the community. Very early in our history, within a few years, we became our own 501c3 and are just great friends with the church, but unrelated in terms of our missions or governance structures. St. David Center today is a large multi-service, multidisciplinary children and family service organization with a particular expertise in children's mental health, in autism services, in pediatric rehabilitative therapies, foster care, and early childhood education. We use a collaborative and comprehensive approach and are aiming our services at meeting the needs of and addressing the developmental issues of children who have a range of developmental issues. Those can be in the area of mental health, autism, any range of developmental disabilities that are a result of biology, and then this whole group of children who our community is significantly concerned about, who are at risk for poor developmental outcomes or school failure as a result of adversity that they have faced in their young lives. Those are the kids that we're worried that we're worried and concerned about, because they enter school without the skills, behaviors, or competencies necessary to be successful. And they experience school failure very early in their educational experience, some as young as in their first child care experience, as they're expelled from child care is because of behaviors. So we are, as an organization, we're using this comprehensive approach to address the needs of a large group of children for whom our community should be concerned. And if children facing developmental issues don't access early intervention and treatment early, there is a risk to those children specifically and to our community. They will be unable to succeed in school and to grow up and lead productive lives and be productive members of our community. So our treatment approach is integrated, coordinated, multidisciplinary, which means we have a range of disciplines: occupational therapists, speech therapists, psychologists, social workers, teachers, home visitors, a range of professionals who are funded in a number of different ways to provide services at our center in Minnetonka and out in the community. We have a very distinct goal as an organization to reduce the barriers to accessing services. So that means that our teams of clinicians and professionals are going out into homes and community partner sites throughout Hennepin County, trying to reach the kids who are most vulnerable, most at need, and whose families would struggle to bring them into a center to access
clinical mental health or occupational therapy services. We reach over, as Representative Benson stated, we reach over 2,200 children directly from as a result of our services annually. And if you multiply those children times their family members who are touched, it's upwards of 10,000. And because we're dedicated to reducing barriers, we also provide services throughout the community and have an intern training program so that we can address the shortage in the workforce of mental health providers who have an expertise in children's mental health. So I'd like to turn your attention to some of the materials that I brought along today. There are four sheets in the left-hand side of the folder, and the first one looks like this. It has several charts on it. And just so that you can see in very simple terms, the sheet is named Services, Partners, and Workforce, and it shows you our reach of services across the community. So that first chart will show you the number of clients in each of our specific programs, and just to give you a flavor for where we come up with that 2,200 children, what kinds of services they're directly accessing at St. David Center. The bottom chart is to show you the residency of clients, primarily to show you the reach of our services, that it's across Hennepin County. We touch a little bit into Ramsey and Anoka County as well, but primarily throughout Hennepin County. If you look on the back of that same sheet, it will give you a picture of our partner sites. One of the goals, as I stated, of St. David Center is to bring our clinical teams out into the community. So that means into people's homes, as well as in partnership with other providers in the community where kids who are facing specifically mental health needs, where they are at risk of being expelled. And so our mental health teams will come out and work along those outside those child care center teachers and professionals to help identify the children's needs, diagnose their mental health need, and then provide treatment on site and give the teachers consultation about how to successfully serve those children, and then provide home visiting for the parents as well. The bottom of the chart is a list of, when I say a multidisciplinary team, I wanted you to have an idea of what that team looks like in terms of the numbers, the kinds of professions, and where they're providing services. So in center, at partner sites, and in homes throughout the community. So I'd like to say a little bit more about need, the need in the community, to emphasize what Representative Benson was sharing with you. According to the most recent, one of the recent studies out of the U.S. Surgeon General's office, 1 in 10 children suffers from a diagnosable mental health problem, and yet only 20% of those children are accessing the services they need. So one of our goals as an organization is to change that statistic. That is a tragedy that only 20% of the children who have significant needs are getting early identification and intervention. And as a result of our services, we hope to change that statistic, especially the outreach services. Another statistic is that 4 in 10 children are entering kindergarten without the skills, knowledge, or behaviors necessary to succeed in school, according to the school readiness study, the Minnesota School Readiness Study. And in many of the research studies, you will find that social-emotional issues are one of the biggest barriers of school readiness. Another statistic is that autism is increasing at an epidemic rate. According to the CDC, 1 in 88 children is on the autism spectrum. And estimated by Minneapolis Department of Health and Minneapolis Public Schools, 1 in 28 children, school-aged children in the Somali community have autism spectrum disorder. This is a concern for our community, and St. David's Center has a range of services aimed at addressing the needs of children on the autism spectrum, again, both at our center and through our outreach services throughout the community. So I'd like to turn the corner and tell you a little bit about our renovation project, renovation and expansion project, and I'll turn your attention to this sheet that says campaign overview, one of the four sheets. It says campaign overview. There's a picture of our building on the back of the sheet, and there's an overview of the project and the components. So we are requesting $3.75 million from state bond funds to leverage $8.5 million of private dollars to renovate and expand our center. We have a $12 million project that has been designed by Pope Architects and McGough Construction to take this 90-year-old school building that St. David Center purchased from Hopkins 25 years ago and lightly renovated. We want to take this 90-year-old school building and really turn it into an intervention and treatment center to serve some of the most vulnerable children in our community so that we can serve those children on site in Minnetonka and launch our teams throughout the community, have a template from which to launch our teams out into the community. And our request to the state is to leverage, again, to request $3.75 million of bond funding to leverage $8.5 million from private donations. That will be from individuals, corporations, and foundations. We're at about 30% to that goal to date, and we believe that we can make this full goal with the partnership of the state and the private community. We will be able to serve more children in our center and launch therapy teams throughout the community, and will increase children's access to assessment and early intervention, perhaps within the next 4 years doubling our capacity to identify and intervene with the most vulnerable children with developmental needs. And then this would also include our ability to further reach the state with our 40 interns who we're training in mental health, children's mental health, who will go out and serve across the Minnesota community in the coming years as a result of their training at St. David Center. I would like to pause and just ask Dr. Moore to speak to any further, give you any further information about how St. David Center is meeting the needs of the community, and then see if you have any questions at this point.
If I could ask a question.
Yes.
What's the relationship with Hennepin County, and who owns the building?
We have, our board has agreed to enter into a relationship with Hennepin County, where the Hennepin County would purchase the building and lease back to St. David Center. So both Hennepin County's board and St. David's board have agreed to that arrangement.
Okay, and for the members who don't know, that we cannot give bonding money to a not-for-profit or a for-profit. We can only bond for public-owned facilities. So it could be the county, it could be a city, township, whatever, but not a not-for-profit, even though the not-for-profits are doing a great job.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also say that part of Hennepin County's endorsement and easy yes to the question when we proposed this was that St. David Center provides county contracted services. We have 11 contracts with Hennepin County and are a well-known partner to the Hennepin County Board.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention that I did have a visit with Commissioner Callison, and she assured me directly that the Hennepin County Board is very enthusiastically supporting this and has entered into the agreement that was just discussed.
Dr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Jim Moore. I have practiced pediatrics in Hennepin County, as it turns out, since 1980, and have been medical director at St. David's for approximately 20 years. That title suggests more grandeur than I would want you to necessarily imagine. I consult once a month, twice a month, and have developed a great affection and enthusiasm for what this organization has done for the community and for what it proposes to do with the new project that you're being asked to consider. I'm here partly on behalf of St. David's, but I'm also here on behalf of myself and my colleagues who see children and families in our practices day after day, week after week, who ask for our help solving mental health issues, family relationships issues, dealing with developmental problems that are not easily solved in many cases by the medical model. We have here in Minnesota, I believe, excellent primary child health care and specialty children's health services, But we've struggled to meet the need for the families whose issues are more in the social-emotional domain. What my colleagues and I are most in need of are community-based partners who are prepared to meet the needs of the children in their homes with their families over a long enough period of time that change not only occurs, but change will endure. And my experience with St. David's over the last 20 years is this is the kind of model that most successfully accomplishes that aim. I don't have any further comments prepared, but I'm obviously eager to answer any questions you might have about how St. David's might complement services that are provided by pediatricians and family doctors.
Are there any questions for Dr. Moore? Representative
Gruenegger. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, if I heard right, and I had to step in and out a little bit, I apologize for that. The you have $8 million of private money. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? Yes, we are raising $8.5 million of private money, and we are 30% toward goal.
Representative
Gruenegger. Oh, so. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that means that the project wouldn't go ahead until you raise the $8 million. Is that correct?
Ms. Jordahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we will raise the $8.5 million as well as at our goal is to raise the $8.5 million as well alongside this bond funding.
Okay, just one follow-up. Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what your projected square foot cost is, per square foot cost? Of this addition and renovation,
Ms. Jordahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't come prepared to answer that question. I will say that there is a square footage cost for the renovation and a square footage cost for the expansion. I could get an answer to that. Have documents. Didn't come prepared with that specific answer today.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. Just one of the things that Mr. Chair, just follow up is you know, I haven't been on the school board. One of the ways I evaluated projects was the per square foot cost. And I'll tell you, they really, with some government projects, the per square foot cost just gets way out of line for some reason. And the result is when you get those figures, you're able to evaluate them and compare them to what, you know, the commercial companies do. And in our school district, we save several hundred thousand dollars just by asking some questions about the per square foot cost. And I'm sure yours is real fine, but it's one way for a layperson like myself or people on the committee who aren't familiar with construction to be able to evaluate the request. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for either Dr. Sorry, I can't read the names here. Moore and
Ms. Julie Shortle.
Shortle. First question is this: you have this chart here on in your handout. It's a graph. It shows brain development, and it goes from birth to 36 months, and then it shows outcomes for different for parents when they're college educated, working class, low income. So how can you explain how you're addressing, since that age is critical, I mean, that brain development, and how your program address or is trying to help provide services for those that are infant to 36 months?
Dr. Mark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, one of the initiatives that's going on at the moment through Minnesota Department of Education is an expanded effort at early childhood screening. Early childhood screening will be offered in primary care settings for all children throughout the state of Minnesota through the Help Me Grow program. These children will be seen as early as 9 months. They'll be evaluated using a tool called Ages and Stages Questionnaire. And on the basis of what the graph shows you here, We anticipate that children who are lagging will be identified more quickly and referred both to the Help Me Grow program that's administered by local school districts, and when it's appropriate, to community-based agencies like St. David's. This is relatively new, very exciting, I think, for those of us who care about early childhood, and perhaps will allow this graph to be compressed more so that there is less of a difference between children growing up in more privileged circumstances and the others who have unmet needs.
Representative Allen.
Thank you for that. And then the next chart here below that, the outcomes of, would you talk a little bit more about that, about from a medical perspective, about or what these, and explain a little bit about these adverse experiences, and maybe a little bit more about what types of experiences and which are most harmful, and tying that to sort of outcome.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, there's a very large body of research that dates back 40, 50 years on the impact of life experiences that occur not only for the child but for his or her parents, translating into developmental difficulties that appear within days or weeks in some cases. Inadequate prenatal care is an example of something that occurs before the child is even born. Exposure to substances like tobacco, alcohol, drugs of various kinds, these things occur right away. Those are adverse experiences that begin before birth. They continue after birth. If a mother experiences poverty, if a mother experiences domestic violence, these all translate into developmental sequelae for the child. Those kids begin to look different almost immediately to the pediatrician. The problems that those families bring to us in our offices are things that we don't have immediate tools to deal with, and it's why we are so eager to have community partners that can reach out to families that are experiencing that kind of difficulty.
Representative Allen.
Thank you. And to follow up on that, and is there read some studies where you have these very traumatic experiences such as domestic violence or exposure to substances, or but what about it, the studies I read was that those types of adverse experiences that a child can is harmed by them, but oftentimes can recover more quickly, but that the one type of adverse experience is general neglect, and how that neglect is actually more harmful than having, say, seven or eight specific experiences.
Dr. Marr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, general neglect is a difficult thing to define, and I guess I'm going to say something about maternal depression. Many of you have heard that children whose mothers experience postpartum depression or even depression during pregnancy run into difficulty in the office. They are often children desperate for attention who appear to be hyperactive, disorganized, and the mothers are under-responsive. Over a period of time, we might call that neglect. It's difficult to say who is the victim of neglect, the mother whose depression hasn't been diagnosed and addressed, or the child who's needing active parenting and not receiving it. But it does have a major impact on that child as he or she grows, and those experiences have begun almost from the first days of life, as is by definition the case with postpartum depression. Kids don't bounce back from that, you're right. they can bounce back. One of the things I learned in my residency was that the child who experiences physical abuse certainly has needs, has sequelae. But if it's an isolated event, regardless of how devastating it might have been at the time, there's a better prognosis for that child than the child who's experienced prolonged neglect and inadequate nurturing and support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have one other question if we have time. It's just sure. Quick. Just a question to explain. On this chart here, you have services, partners, workforce, and it has identifying children that have been served and the types of services provided. And I was interested in do you have speech occupational therapy as serving the majority of children, the majority of children receive those types of services, and then also how does that correlate with the personal care services? And if you could talk a little bit about that population and those types of services and what you're seeing there.
Ms. Shorter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Allen. Speech and occupational therapy is an outpatient clinic that we have on our site in Minnetonka, and we also do some of that through outreach. The number is representative of when you asked about the number being more significant. It's 1 to 2 hours of service per week, so we can serve a higher number of children in that clinical program as compared to, for example, the Autism Day treatment number. Those same children come to the center 5 days a week for 20 hours of service. The same group of six children come and stay in one group of children for an entire year or year and a half, as opposed to the outpatient clinic. They can come in and do it, be engaged in a treatment for perhaps 6 months until that treatment, until they've achieved their goals, and then they move on. So it can be a faster treatment that in which the children come in and out, and it's an outpatient clinic. And our PC personal care attendant services, that's a program funded by medical assistants in which our staff go out and work in people's homes providing personal care for families who have children with developmental disabilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. This is going to be going to the bonding committee, and the questions there will be the bondability of the project, the legality of this nonprofit status, which is something that we're always going to look at, and also the regional significance and regional impact of the project relative to other projects. We've got a lot of requests from from nonprofits. We've got in every one of our districts, we've got nonprofits that do really good work, some similar, some not. I think for the purview of this committee, the correct questions to ask would be in choosing to fund this project in this area relative or in comparison to other projects in other districts that are doing similar or like or similar good work. Number one, and one of the questions we'll have in bonding committee is, what is the history of the state bonding for specifically for nonprofits that do these types of services in the community, medical or social service? I'm trying to think of historically what we've done, so that'll probably be a question. And then there's a scale of services that are provided that are offered completely and totally in the private market, such as childhood daycare, which would be offered competitively with other projects similarly in the area. And then there's other services that are provided that aren't offered by anyone else, either in the medical community, social services community, or private community. So there's that scale of services that you offer. And when we make the difficult decisions about which projects to fund and which not to fund, The important question to ask is, what is that balance? And to the extent that we are subsidizing good work, but good work that isn't going to be in competition wholly or in part with the private market or with other subsidized social service or nonprofit or public services provided in that area. So those are the two major questions I think that I would have going forward for you, and maybe that you want to sharpen up a little bit for the next committee, that I'm sure that they'll be asked again in that committee, and you might want to just follow up with that with me in between. So that's it.
Okay, you know, and Representative Dean and other members, this particular group is one in which you cannot separate the health care part of their needs versus the social services. And, if there is the integration in between those two, it's a real benefit to these kids. Any other questions, comments? Representative Zeros.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess either of the testifiers, looking through your service partners and workforce here, 2011-2012 reach of service, just a quick question on the number of children served. I'm wondering, are these all unique individual children, or are they unique individual? If you have someone that's in Children's Mental Health Clinic and that reaches up to 123 there for children served, and then you have Children's Mental Health Case Management, if you have someone that's seen in clinic but also has case management service, is that two ticks, or is that one child fall in one of those two buckets?
Shortall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zerwas. Is that your name? Okay. That's a great question, and I wish I could answer with such crystal clarity that an electronic medical record system will give us. We're right in the middle of an implementation of an electronic medical record system, so a year from now my data will be crystal clear. There are duplicated counts in that 2200, so some children do, to your question, some children will be in the mental health clinic that also will receive a pediatric rehabilitative therapy. I can't tell you exactly the percent of that duplication given our data, our current data system, but there are some duplicates. It's not a large number.
Representative Zeros.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow up. Yeah, I think that'll be important information. How many unique individuals, clients you're working with, I think will be important moving forward. And then, don't know if you can answer this, but on page 5, which I say, this is really nice. Looks expensive, but really nice. But in page 5 of your packet here for your financial overview, actually, let's go to page before that, page 4 for your campaign goals. Down at the bottom for urgent need, you have inadequate resources for professional and preparation and ongoing training, and you have established the Advancing the Field Endowment. Is that the endowment that the endowment fund that you're referring to then on page 5?
Ms. Shortall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, yes, that is. That is the endowment.
Okay, and then just one last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Zerwas. Thank you so much. So walk me through the campaign expenses then, because the way I'm reading this, you're spending total campaign expenses, 12.25 million, and so you have, I'm reading it like we're spending $1 million out of that endowment fund that you're looking to build, and then through your campaign revenue, through individual fundraising, foundations, events, state bonding, then you're raising back $1 million for that endowment. And so I'm wondering kind of how that works, and if you could walk me through that.
Ms. Shortall.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, a couple of ways to answer this question. Our original preparation of these materials was primarily for the general public. Were I to have these materials just be in front of the legislators, we might have removed that endowment so as not to confuse the issue, but our materials needed to match in the community as they do in front of you. That endowment actually was already gifted. It was a gift by the one of the co-chairs of our capital campaign to, with his knowledge of how desperately needed professional development dollars are in this field, and to stay abreast of the current research and evidence-based practices, he invested an endowment from which we will begin to draw dividends in the next couple of years. And so that is stated in here as both a campaign goal and fundraising goal that was from the very beginning of the project raised.
Yeah. Did you have another question?
Well, just one more question, I guess, now, Mr. Chair, if I may. Mm-hmm. All right, I'll go. It looks like, so that changes it a little bit, because then that changes your campaign revenue, your total campaign revenue for our purview to 11.25, and so you're requesting 3.75 million out of 11.25, and not the 12.25. So it becomes a bigger portion. So your pie chart isn't really accurate for our point of view. It changes the scope of your ask in percent to your capital project pretty significantly.
Mr. Erdahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative, indeed it does change it a little bit. It's 30% of the 12.25 million and 33% of the 11.25 million. It would still be within the legislative guidelines of a match, 50% match, I believe. So, but it is a significant request, and we're grateful to be able to share our request with you.
Mr. Zeros, and I will say that, you know, we have another bill up, and we've got people that come from a distance to testify on that one.
No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, and that's my final question. I just thank you for the clarity.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it very brief and can maybe follow up offline or via email or something. But I guess two quick questions. One, I'm wondering, I don't see anything in here in terms of how the participation with parents and kids that are, is it a sliding fee? Who pays for the treatment of these children? Is public dollars used? Is it mostly private funding, scholarships, things of that nature? And then I guess my second question would just be, I don't see any numbers in here in terms of the allocation for the marketing of your capital campaign in terms of cost of these print materials, things like that. Wondering if you can point me to information, or if you could follow up with providing that information, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Shortall.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so to answer the first question, our funding comes from a variety of sources. Medical assistance is about 50% of our funding. Hennepin County social service contracts, approximately another 10%. Insurance revenue, we have contracts with all of the major insurance companies, so insurance revenue is another 20%. Charitable revenue and private pay. And certainly, depending on the funding source and the program, is parents' payments are dependent on that. So any of the Hennepin County programs, for example, there is not a parent copay component. For insurance, there's certainly a parent copay. Medical assistance, none. It's variable depending on the program, and we do have sliding fee scales for those that are the programs that they're a private pay. And in answer to your second question, that line that says financing, business interruption, and fundraising, those costs are all captured in that line.
Okay, then I would thank you for your testimony, and I would renew my motion that House File 396 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Bonding Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
Well, I'm just going to conclude by saying there's a lot of discussion on all kinds of subjects here in the legislature, whether it has to do with gun violence and all that debate. Many people, I think, on all sides of the aisle do agree that the mental health component is a key, that we have bipartisan support in trying to address. And wouldn't it be nice, Mr. Chairman and members, if we began to deal with mental health issues when children are beginning to exhibit these difficulties, instead of, you know, catching people at the bottom of the stream? Let's do something before they get thrown in at the top. And I think these kinds of programs are ones that, in a bipartisan way, we ought to seriously consider supporting, because it gets at one of the really fundamental problems of violence in this country and inability of people to function when they grow up. And so this is an enormous cost savings for our society over the long term. And even though we only run every 2 years, we ought to think of the long term for our state and our country and our children.
All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the House File 396 is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Bonding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we have House File 558, Representative Fritz.
Good morning.
Fritz, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, if I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like you to move House File 558 to be included.
Recommended to pass.
Recommended to pass.
And included in the laid over for possible inclusion. And oh, this is this a bonding one too?
It's bonding.
Okay, I re-referred to the bonding committee.
Well, thank you. I'll try to be quick. I do have a couple of testifiers. You know, I brought this legislation before this committee in the past, and you've been very gracious and generous, and the bonding committee has always helped us. There is a handout you might want to look at it. The Remembering with Dignity is the name of the report. And in my district, Faribault, I have a number of unmarked, numbered graves from the citizens that were state institutionalized at the Faribault State School and Hospital many, many years ago. And then there are other institutions, state institutions, that we own that also had people residing there who died and then were placed in a cemetery plot with a numbered stake. And we have been able, through the folks here, to restore some of those sites and to put a headstone. And I would like to turn it over at this time to my right is Hallie O'Fally, from ACT, who will give a brief testimony about how many graves we've done, how many we have left to do. And the amount that we're asking to get in bonding is $1 million. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, and would you state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hallie O'Fally, and I'm the community organizer for Remembering with Dignity. And I would like to say thank you for your continued effort and support of this project. You've made a commitment to Remembering with Dignity. Of the 13,000 people that were buried in unmarked or numbered grave markers, we have done over 7,000 already. There is a picture on here of some of the grave markers. There were different types of grave markers that were used. These were from Hastings State Hospital. We found these because they were thrown over the sand coolly by the groundskeepers because they would pop up over the expansion and contraction of cement. So there was a total disregard, unfortunately. These people were buried who lived in the state hospital institutions. They were not from the county poor farms. It was people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and then quite often women with postpartum depression. So right now we're working in Faribault. We're working on the first three cemeteries. People who were buried from 1866 to 1823, there's 300 people. We're also starting to work on Fergus Falls, where there's over 3,000 people who were buried with the numbered grave markers. We have restored like I said, over 7,000 already. 8 of the 28 cemeteries have been restored. And with the current bill that we're working on and the bill that we're introducing now, when we're done with that, there will be 16 cemeteries that will be completely restored. And along with this, we do a lot of public awareness in the community organizing that we do, empowering people with disabilities. And we do a lot of art projects around that, too, and storytelling. And so thank you very much.
Yeah. Chairman and...
Go ahead.
I have another testifier.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Melvin Aiden, I'm a member of ACT. Many years I'm on the Remember DD project, and I was at most of these sites many times. And I was at the committee, I'm no gum, 18th register. Looking forward to work with Fergus Falls and Saint what's with Saint Peter and Wilmer and that's I was in on committees with lots of people. What we are working on, I mean, we're just looking forward to work with Fergus Falls by families from up there, Fergus Falls.
Thank you. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was actually at the Faribault, one of the cemeteries in Faribault this last year. We had a dedication, and we had busloads and carloads of folks, family, who were able to recognize their loved one's grave and actually come and had flowers, and they were able to lay flowers at their relatives' grave sites. It was a very, very moving and wonderful experience, and I would just offer that experience to any of you who have any of these cemeteries in your area. One of our sites is right behind the prison that we have in Faribault, and we have the prisoners are weeding and cleaning up and keeping neatly trimmed the area of where these are, these graves are. So it's been and then there's a trail. We have the River Bend Nature Trail there as well. So and you can you know swerve off the trail and go back through and into a lovely, well-kept cemetery that has dignity for the folks that we found that had just a stake with a number on it, for, letting us know that they were once on this earth. So I do appreciate and do want to share that opportunity for you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this, and thank you for the testifiers for coming here today. And I just want to let people know, I mean, this has been coming up every bonding cycle, and we've funded it. And at first, when I first heard of this years ago, I thought, why are we spending money on people who are dead? And then I realized from going to some of the events and the dedication and that this really isn't for people who are dead. This is for people who are living. It's really about honoring the fact that people with disabilities have dignity and are no different than the rest of us, and their families are the family members who were disabled and who were treated really in a way that we would never accept today. We want to try to say that that those were the bad old days and those days are gone. So this is really an important thing to continue. And so I just wanted to add my voice to that's why I really support this, even though perhaps in one sense we might say, why would we do this? I think it's really worth doing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fritz, thanks for bringing this forward. I remember seeing this last year as well and kind of thought the same lines with Representative Liebling, but you are correct. It is for the living, and we must remember the dignity of human life. So with that said, I believe the funding is appropriate to a point, but perhaps I missed it. Are you sharing it with some of the cost sharings with some local civic groups and towns and communities, VFWs, Legionnaires, if one of the deceased was perhaps a veteran of some sort? So are you sharing some of the cost with some of your local communities as well as the state?
Ms. Valdez.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The state the state of Minnesota made an apology to the people who were institutionalized, and this is part of the state's responsibility in that it was a way that people were treated totally disrespectfully. We don't do that kind of stuff to our loved ones. And we, when we first started out, we did, but the state made a commitment, and then we have the apology. So that's what we're working with. And do you have anything, any other way you want to ask me that?
Representative McDowell.
Oh, thank you. So no, then, just the state is doing the
yes, just funding. The state is.
No other organization, okay.
Okay, other questions? I don't see anything, so Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 558 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Bonding Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So it is passed and referred to the Bonding Committee.
Thank you, thank Mr. You, Chairman. Thank you, members.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you.
And the testifiers.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned.